From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen.
Okay, this is it. Maybe we should just call it Day because this is the final broadcast of Day to Day.
This show first hit the air on July 28th, 2003. Today, we promised to go out with a bang, but we want to start off looking at how much has changed in the world over the past 5 years or so.
A lot has happened. For instance, the war in Iraq had just started. In fact, by the time we first went to air, then-President Bush had already declared mission accomplished.
Of course, U.S. troops are still there, and combat troops will be there until August of 2010.
Then, about 2 weeks after Day to Day launched, there was that huge blackout on the East Coast. I was in New York City that day. I was actually reporting for the show, and Alex Chadwick was the host.
Is electricity back on locally just where you are?
Just where we are, no, but there are spots where the power is back on.
Okay.
Times Square, for instance.
How did people spend the night?
People spent the night in all manner of strange ways. Some people actually slept in parks. Some people crashed at friends' houses in Manhattan if they couldn't get out. Other people I spoke to walked 3 hours downtown and across the Brooklyn Bridge or the Manhattan Bridge to get to Brooklyn. And people who decided just to make the best of it. There were people outside drinking, partying.
I have to say, I was one of those people. I mean, after I got off the air, of course.
Day to Day has always prided itself on being a partying show and a West Coast show. And back here in California, things are really different now than they were when Day to Day first started. Well, sort of. There's a huge budget deficit now, and there was one back then, too. In fact, former Governor Gray Davis was booted from office in large part because of that deficit.
We had Governor Gray Davis on our first show. Here's Alex asking him about the efforts to kick him out of office.
You must know how voters go here. What difference is it going to make if Arnold Schwarzenegger gets in the race?
Doesn't make any difference at all.
Really?
No.
Governor Davis, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, and welcome to California.
And, of course, we all know how that race went. But here's something interesting, Madeline. In light of the economic meltdown that started with subprime mortgages and the crash of the housing market, do you know what the median home price was nationally back then when the show started?
No, no idea.
About $177,000. And just for a little sense of where it all winds up, February of this year, it's at about $180,000.
The world has changed a lot in the last 5 years. That's history. But what about the future? We want to know how we might be living 5 years from today. Joining me now is Joel Kotkin. He's the author of the book, The City, A Global History, as well as the book, The New Geography. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
All right. So most of the news from the past year has been driven by the collapse of the housing market. And let's talk about what that's going to mean for us 5 years from now. How will that change where people live and how they live?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure how much it will change where they live. I think it's going to affect when they move there. In other words, I think that in the short run, this is, of course, very catastrophic for people, and people aren't going anywhere because they can't sell their homes. And if housing prices remain somewhat down from the highs of the last few years, I think there'll be a lot of opportunity for people to actually go out and buy homes or condominiums in areas that they want to live in. You'll see a period right now of stasis and then a period of great dynamism once the economy begins to recover.
Well, we did see a period of great dynamism when it came to building these houses in places where there actually hadn't been any houses before. So there was this great outward push of the exurbs, and places like Metro Las Vegas became the fastest growing areas in the country. Is that going to just pick up where it left off 5 years from now, or will we see another place that'll be hot, another area of the country, another kind of area where people will be living?
I think fundamentally what's going to drive mobility and where people are going to want to live is going to be jobs. So people are going to go to those places where they can find employment. Interestingly enough, some places like Texas are continuing to attract lots of people, while places like Las Vegas and Phoenix, not so much as they were before.
And what about for traditional cities, the New Yorks, the Los Angeleses?
Well, I think it's going to be rough because these places have many problems politically. They're expensive. They're heavily regulated. They have high taxes. New York, of course, is going to go through a very difficult period because about 35% of all the total income in New York City now is dependent on the financial service sector. L.A., I think, is going to be a more of a mixed bag. I mean, California still, you know, has everything going for it except its government. I mean, people are still going to want to come to California. The question is whether or not they're going to be able to stay and find work.
And when you look at government as a whole, I mean, there is just a fundamental shift now in the role government is playing in the economy and in our lives, what with the stimulus package and the bank bailouts. And I'm wondering, in 5 years from now, what do you think that will result in terms of the effects it has on the way you and I live?
Well, I think one of the things is going to be an enormous shift of power to Washington, D.C., a concentration of power such as we have not seen probably since the Second World War. We're going to have much, much more emphasis on going on your hands and knees to Washington. I don't think it's necessarily a very good development, but I think it's going to have an enormous impact. Clearly, we're going to be a lot less of a market-based economy, at least in the next 4 or 5 years, than we have been in the past.
Joel Kotkin is the author of the book, The City, A Global History. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With enough minds, all tomorrows are visible. That's the motto you'll find at Jaime Cascio's website. It's called OpenTheFuture.com. Cascio writes about the future of the Earth and about technology's role in it. He's also the author of the book called Hacking the Earth. Jaime Cascio joins me now from a studio at Stanford University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You have said that the future we create is a future that we can be proud of. So here's the big question. How do we do that?
The funny thing is the answer is going to sound almost prosaic, and that is we need to try. We have such a perception that the future happens to us. And really, the future is a process, and it's something that we all create together. And the more we are conscious of our role in creating the future, whether it's through our building new tools or engaging with each other in collaborative projects, the better chance we have of creating a future that we like.
Technology already plays such a crucial role in our lives now. How do you see that unfolding in the years ahead?
Well, the technologies that I'm really looking at are those around energy and around social collaboration and around making things. You know, there are all sorts of really interesting new tools that are coming out that give us really powerful new capacities, especially distributed capacities.
Last year, you put out a computer game called Superstruct, where players played basically themselves in the future. And that future in your game was a really bleak world. And some might argue not that dissimilar from what we're facing now. I'm curious what that experience taught you about the roles that all of us can play in this notion that you referred to earlier of making our own future, of letting it be something more than what happens to us.
The world that we created as the base story was intentionally provocative and frightening because we wanted to really force people to think through how they could change things. What we were looking for was how would they work together? And the ideas that people came up with around building new institutions, creating new forms of cooperation, new ways of helping each other, new ways of innovating, it gave us a lot of hope that things actually, as bad as they seem today, there's a real opportunity for creating a 21st century that we can be proud of.
Can you give us a specific example of something that people came up with?
It was a group of people who, using an emerging technology known as 3D printing, sometimes called fabbing, F-A-B-B-I-N-G, mm-hmm. fabricating. It's a technology that's available today, but is generally used either to create flimsy, fragile demo pieces of various consumer products, or it's used at the high end to make fuselage parts for aircraft. And it's basically the construction of material components layer by layer at a very microscopic level, such that what you get is a solid piece that can be, in some cases, quite literally printed at your desk. And this technology is getting really cheap, really fast. What this group in Superstruct came up with was the idea that once these tools become sufficiently inexpensive, they become a way for communities to support each other, to be able to have bottom-up distributed industries. Because if you think about it for a moment, a world where you can walk down to the local copy center, and instead of getting a copy of a document, you actually get a copy of a pair of shoes. Or you go and you spend $1,000 on a desktop printer that can print a new toy for your kid. And so what we're moving very close to is a point where it become possible to quite literally print a cell phone at your desk. This notion that suddenly these kinds of technologies aren't just created by people hundreds or thousands of miles away and shipped to you, but instead are things that you can make for yourself, that can be really disruptive and powerful.
Jaime Cascio is author of the book Hacking the Earth, and he blogs at openthefuture.com. Thanks, Jaime.
Thank you very much.
So, Madeline, that is what is perhaps off a little bit in the distant future. But let's talk about the immediate future. You've got some exciting new plans. Where will we find you?
Where will you find me? You're going to find me dealing with this new technology, the technology that is actually here now. I have started a podcast. It's called Parenting on the Edge. It's about parenting, and a blog, of course. And it's at MadelineBrand.com. So you can find me there and at Facebook.
And if you're looking for me out there, don't confuse me with the Israeli DJ or the internet marketer, both of whom are also named Alex Cohen. You can find me at alexcoheninla.blogspot.com.
And one of our listeners is also excited about her future. Amy Ignatow wrote into the show in response to our request for essays about memorable goodbyes. We've chosen a few of those to air throughout the program today. Here's Amy with her goodbye, which is happening right now.
Back in August, I lost my job teaching art, and I became a full-time freelance illustrator. And the work dried up very quickly because none of the nonprofits that usually hire me could afford to put out publications. And so my fiancé said, just work on your book, and when you sell it for $1 million gazillion, I will be a wonderful house husband. Well, it didn't go for $1 million gazillion, but in November, I did sell it as part of a two-book deal, and in a few weeks, we're going to be moving out of our apartment. My fiancé cannot be a house husband just yet, but we do have a house, so it's a start. So goodbye, crumbly apartment, and goodbye, crazy neighbor who screams at people who park too near to her spot. Goodbye, terrible weird noise that comes from the back of the nearby restaurant. And goodbye to horrible feelings that getting an art degree was a stupid, selfish thing to do. And hello to my new life as a published author.
Amy Ignatow and her fiancé closed on their house and mailed their wedding invitations yesterday.
No, rien de rien.
Though our show goes away today, we will always survive online. Go to npr.org/daydreaming. Stay with us. Day to Day continues. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. Whoever said it's hard to say goodbye probably never checked out a rap record. In the world of hip-hop, there are 1,001 ways to bid farewell. Here's NPR's Christopher Johnson with just a few of them.
Okay, how do I put this? I have to go. I've always been bad at goodbyes. Fortunately, I love hip-hop, and rappers have made up all sorts of goodbyes, so I'll let them do the talking.
The guys don't stop until it's time to say peace.
Peace, I think, is one of the best ways to depart with somebody.
Wu-Tang Clan co-founder and slang Dr. the RZA, he's flipped the standard goodbye, peace, into all sorts of acronyms.
Over the years, I made about 50 of those up. I'll give you a couple. Positive education, always correct errors. You got power equality, always see everything. We have please educate all children every day.
I'm out.
Now I look free when I'm out.
And I'm out.
And sick and I'm out. Peace out.
Culture critic and self-proclaimed media assassin, Harry Allen.
People saying I'm out at one point stretched into I'm outie, which stretched into outie 5000.
Outie like 5G's.
Audi 5000 being a make of car that was popular at the time.
In Oakland, we say scrape.
Youth Radio's King Anye Howe tuned me in to how younger folks part company on the streets in the Bay Area.
I'm about to scrape. It's like saying goodbye. When you have a car, it's called a scraper. And when you're about to leave, you're about to scrape. You're about to bounce.
Let's bounce, which is one I like for the picture it conveys.
For sure. That's how people go, yo, for sure, yo, for sure.
Sometimes, you know, I don't even say nothing. Sometimes I just pound on my chest twice.
Go on.
Like you're trying to burp.
Yeah, like I got something stuck in my...
Holla at me, you know what I mean? I mean, see you later, holla at me, catch me later, you know what I mean?
It might be bigger than hip-hop. It might be something that extends to people of African descent wherever they are.
Jamaicans say, be easy. My uncle, he just says easy, which could be, you know, take it easy. And now it's gotten to the point where we get off the phone, he's just like, easy.
We can shake the spot.
My guess is that it's based on rhythm.
Piece of mouth, chanting like a runaway slave.
This primacy of rhythm It's what drives our semantic innovation.
Peace, and then
handle
your business.
Throw out the peace sign.
Two fingers.
I got it. I'm gone.
They call it deuces. Sometimes you say, just say deuces.
And we out of here.
So you can visualize the two fingers being thrown up, the deuce.
Peace. That was NPR's Christopher Johnson. It's the last time you'll hear him on this show. You can keep up with his work, radio, and more at his site, yourplanb.org. But don't go there just yet. The site launches on May 11th. Yourplanb.org.
This show has featured plenty of amazing reporters. Karen Grigsby Bates is one of them, and she frequently reported for us on books. Karen is back with us today with this literary appreciation.
For a bibliophile, Day-to-Day was the perfect place to work. The whole staff was interested in books, and our tastes were wide-ranging. We consumed everything from serious novels to pop fiction to biographies, memoirs, even books on policy. Authors knew that, and they liked to visit with us. I consider myself particularly blessed to have had conversations with writers whose works I admired, and many of them wrote about life in the West, not the John Ford, John Wayne, Louis L'Amour West, but today's West, with all of its pleasures and complexities. Walter Mosley told me how surprised he was to come upon his mild-mannered father on the first evening of the Watts riots in 1965.
On one night during the riots, I came into a room and my father was there drinking, and he was, on the way to being drunk, and he was crying and was very upset. And I said, "Dad, what's wrong?" And he said, "It's these riots." And I said, "Are you afraid?" He said, "I'm not afraid, Walter. I want to go out there. I want to get a gun. I want to get some Molotov cocktails. I want to go out there and fight."
That anger became the basis for Mosley's bestseller, Little Scarlet. The late Joan Didion confessed that for all her years in New York, she remained a California girl at heart.
I still have a California driver's license.
Do you really?
Yes, I've always had it. it has my New York address on it now.
Susan Strait writes about contemporary California. She took me on a driving tour of a vanishing part of it.
See the trees right here? This orange grove stretched from there, from here, all the way up to the top of that street. And this was the orange groves that used to run in and steal your fruit and play.
We were so fond of books on this show that we had a prize-winning book critic, David Kippen from the San Francisco Chronicle. David's unpretentious, enthusiastic embrace of the written word was deep enough to retain the serious book person and real enough to draw in even the occasional reader. Here he explains the genesis of a discipline we now take for granted.
The story of modern American cultural criticism is the story of three California girls who went east. Pauline Kael, Susan Sontag, and Joan Didion. Of the three, only Didion has ever copped to any homesickness.
I think that's kind of how we'll feel when Day-to-Day is gone after today. Homesick. People here will move on to other jobs and other shows. Their careers will continue to evolve, but somehow we've been stamped by the imprint of this lovely, quirky show that looked at the world from the West, and that's to the good. Kazuo Ishiguro, another Day-to-Day author, told me that in his sci-fi coming-of-age novel, Never Let Me Go, he wanted to impress upon his readers that time is indeed fleeting.
I was trying to celebrate the small decencies of human beings set against this dark background that's in all our lives. It's actually that we all live with a countdown going on.
And the clock for this show has run out. It's been an amazing time, this 5-plus years full of discovery and hair-raising deadlines done, speaking of dark backgrounds, Kazuo, in the pitch black of early, early morning. It was worth it. Those of us who left the staff before today still consider ourselves part of it. We still listened for our old show from our new desks. Former book critic David Kippen.
It was always a consolation to me when I took up my current job to know that it was still going on, and it pinches my heart a little bit to know that it won't be.
Mine too. For Day-to-Day, I'm Karen Grigsby Bates.
All right, here's another slice of heartache for you. More of a comic tragedy, really. It's a goodbye essay from our listener, Stephen H. Miller.
My girlfriend, we'll call her Rosebud, came down from Dartmouth to spend Thanksgiving with me in New York. But on Friday, she decided to go back to be with her other boyfriend, Rod, for his birthday. So I knew it was over. A blizzard was burying the East Coast. The train from Washington, D.C., through New York and up to New Hampshire, was running 4 hours late. Rosebud and I bought a bottle of peach brandy and strolled around. Midtown Manhattan was all steam and slush, so the cold wasn't uncomfortable, but the conversation was. At 1 a.m., I took her aboard the train. I knew it was really our last goodbye. While I lingered on a last kiss, the train began to move. I ran to the conductor. who said, "We're 4 hours late. We're not stopping." I had to ride to the next train station, the suburban town of Rye, New York. The station was locked up tight and hemmed in by snowdrifts, so I stood on the frozen platform sipping peach brandy until a southbound came by at 6:30 a.m. It took 3 days to get the cold out of my bones, longer to get her out of my heart. I'm happily married now to someone else for 20 years. After Rod, Rosebud became a lesbian.
That kicker from listener Stephen H. Miller, a professional writer in Los Angeles. NPR's Day to Day continues. This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. And talk about a Day to Day original, Mike Pesca. He covered just about everything for this show, and he did it with incredible flair. Pesca's back with these thoughts on wrapping things up.
You ever notice how on 24, whenever Kiefer Sutherland tortures a guy, he gets usable intel? Yeah, said Martha Little, my editor. Well, I was watching the program The Shield, and the opposite happened. The torture didn't work. I think it was a direct reaction to 24. That sounds interesting, says producer Chip Grabo. That phrase, "that sounds interesting," was the unstated motto of Day to Day when I worked there. A reporter with an ill-defined beat, me, gets a notion, mentions it in a pitch meeting, and is encouraged to follow through. The story makes air.
I'm going to get to the truth. I didn't do it!
That's not the way torture actually works, and that method usually does not yield positive results.
A few months later, I'm listening to Terry Gross on Fresh Air interview someone from a human rights group who has nominated that episode of The Shield for a media award. The human rights activist later tells me he heard the report, my report, our report, on Day to Day. Last week, a publicist called to offer an interview with the diet detective. I remember him, I say. We went undercover together to Crumb's Bakery to research cupcakes.
Okay, we got blackout, coconut, Boston cream. Wow. Do you have any whole wheat?
No. To their credit, Crumb's does not have whole wheat. Because of that report on Day to Day, the publicist tells me the diet detective got his own TV show. What I'm saying is that there is no better gauge of a radio show than the TV shows it inspires. Okay, that is not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that for the 5¾ years that Day to Day chased after that which was interesting, I was very happy to be the one dispatched to travel wherever the interesting took place, 26 states by my count. The reporting was also far-flung conceptually. I opened 30 Pepsi bottles on air to prove the company had miscalculated contest odds. I interviewed a loaf of bread. I was encouraged to find unusual ways to examine the decline of the U.S. sock industry.
I'm not threatened.
Lamb Chop is the world's most famous sock puppet.
I am quite confident in the ability of the U.S. sock to compete in the open market.
This has been an Annus Horribilis radioist for me. Many of my favorite radio programs, commercial and public, went away, from shows I worked on for a while.
This was the Bryant Park Project.
To the program I grew up on as a sports-loving New Yorker.
You learn that the Mike and the Mad Dog program will be no more.
The one Howard Stern replacement who's really hitting his stride was canceled.
We're taking me off, and we're putting some Rihanna on, and some Timberlake on, and some Fergalicious on.
Even this reassuring voice will be heard no more.
Paul Harvey, good day.
Of course, the end of Day to Day is the hardest hit in many ways. My friends work there, my NPR career started there, I got to interview a sock. In searching for advice on how to close it out, I thought back to a story I had just covered in October, the World Series. Closer Brad Lidge was in the locker room, having just completed a perfect season, a save in every opportunity, including the save in the World Series. A few years ago, after Lidge gave up a big postseason home run, his career was considered ruined. But even when his statistics were among the worst in baseball, Lidge retained a Nietzschean outlook.
If you really look at any great closer in this game, it seems like they've all gone through a situation, maybe not exactly like that, but something where they give up a home run in a big situation. It just kind of happens, and I think whatever doesn't kill you makes you better.
Let's take our lesson on closing from the best closer in the game. Trust your stuff, trust yourself, don't be defined by your setbacks. Lidge could have let the story end with a ball sailing over his head for a home run. Instead, it ended in perfection. Baseball fans thrill to the achievement, fans of human drama admire his perseverance, and we all listen because the story sounds interesting. For Day to Day, I'm Mike Pesca.
Okay, here's another interesting story. It's an essay from one of our listeners, Phil Marriage, on saying goodbye.
I haven't said my most memorable goodbye yet, but I know it could be at any time.
I've been painting and doing contracting work with my dad since I was a kid. He's still going strong, but every New Year's Eve, I find myself wondering if this year might be the year I lose him. We began working together back in 1967 and still do, even though I have to yell out the dimensions now and try to keep him off the ladder. I know the last goodbye is coming. I just hope it happens someday on the job as he puts the finishing touches on one of our projects. That's the way he'd want it. He's still a pretty good painter, but an even greater dad.
That's one of our listeners, Phil Marriage, talking about his dad, Ray. He's 85 years old and still working in Hot Springs, Arkansas. We have more listener goodbyes at our website, npr.org. There's more coming up on Day to Day from NPR News. And now we interrupt this program to go back in time.
Hello, is this thing on?
Oh, my God.
Al. Maddie!
Al! Alex Chadwick, everyone, the original host of the show. He's here, too. What are you doing here?
Well, I'm supposed to help you with the credits. I actually came in for the blame, but we're leaving that out of this program.
Good. It's all good news from now on.
Okay, our program would not get on the air if not for Uber producer Chip Grabo, the funniest straight man around.
Also necessary, our brain, definitely mine, editor Martha Little. The director is the elegant Kee Min Sung.
The day-to-day production staff includes Steve Prophet, Mr. Wizard.
Our newest hire, brilliant producer Nancy Fargali. Welcome aboard.
Also recently here, the very cheery producer Andy Houlihan, and Kenya Young. We hope to work for her someday.
The talented temps, Christopher Johnson, an original staffer and an original. Sky Road, a good reporter.
Nihar Patel. We kept trying to hire Nihar, and he'd never agreed to take a job.
How did he know?
Thank you to Day to Day's final intern, Angel Barbizon.
Our editors are the unflappable Jason DeRose, the wickedly wry Jacob Conrad, Sarah Spivak, that energy.
That hair.
And Jolie Myers, who always seems to know what we're going to do before we know what we're going to do.
Our technical director is Leo Dell'Aguila, with engineering help from Carlos Asensio and Marcia Caldwell.
The Day to Day theme was composed by Greg Smith. The executive producer is Deborah Clark, our boss. So many of the good things that happen here are thanks to her.
And the managing editor of NPR West, Cindy Kennard.
Bon voyage, Cindy.
You know, Mad, I've been getting calls and notes. There's a lot of sadness about this day, but it is the first day of spring. Rebirth, renewal. Why don't you come by my place later and let's see what we can dream of.
Okay. You buying?
There is a lot that goes into making a daily radio program, and some of it is not pretty. Fortunately, that stuff usually doesn't get on the air, but today is not a usual day. So, from our senior producer, Steve Prophet, here's a little taste of the chaos we experience and some of the fun we have behind the scenes.
Here we go. From the studios of NPR West. I'm sorry, I'm not ready.
Okay. Gotcha. Forget about saving. Sorry.
We had a little oops moment, but it's okay now. Everything's good.
All right, we have very ill-tempered people in the control room.
I don't get this.
Are we happy? We're happy.
Yeah. Sounds like we're hysterical.
Wow.
Hey, tech center.
What are we doing?
No idea.
Yeah. Prepare to defend yourself.
Oh, my God. This is funny.
Juan Williams, news analyst, senior news analyst. What are they? What
How about sweetheart?
Sweetheart.
You didn't just burp, though, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Don't you wrinkle that brow
at
me.
I'm not wrinkling. I'm waiting.
Wow.
I'll be making my stage debut later.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah, where?
It'll be exit stage left.
A few glimpses of what life was like behind the scenes at Day to Day, compiled by our senior producer, Steve Prophet.
Day to Day returns in a moment.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. You know, for every ending, there's also a beginning, like when a child becomes an adult. Our friends at Youth Radio have these thoughts on growing up.
Being dependent on someone is truly a luxury. And growing up, you're losing that.
I remember those days, and I do cherish the moments. I could fall, rip my pants, go home, cry to my mom, and she clean me up, throw on some new pants, bam. If I do that now, I'm going to be mad because I'm out of some pants.
Whenever I get sick, I think about how I used to be taken care of. Like, Pops would make, like, chicken noodle soup. He would make it from scratch with chickens. It's a good cushion, and once that cushion's gone, like, I figured out I don't know how to take care of myself when I'm sick at all.
The one thing that really made me feel like I was a super adult was when my grandmother passed away. And my mom, she's strong, but for some reason she just couldn't pull herself all the way together. I remember having to arrange for the obituaries to be done. I had to write them. I had to, like, take a lot of responsibility that came with my grandmother's death.
I was ready. I was ready to do anything that was adult. Like, I was the first one of my friends to get an apartment. And my house ended up turning to something like a youth hostel / homeless shelter. Like, at one point, honest to God, there were 6 people sleeping in a studio apartment. I have no food in my fridge except some cheese. And, man, this is what it feels like to be grown up.
When we're kids, we think that, man, I wish I was an adult so I can buy this or I can be able to do that. But then you still kind of miss being a kid again, just going outside, playing tetherball, double dutching. Enjoy it while it lasts because it is so short. That's like the shortest part of your life.
When I was 10 years old, my mom started doing drugs. And at the time, my little brother was born. And she wasn't really focused on him, so that's the time I felt like I can't really just go outside and play in the playground and do this anymore because I have to change diapers and make bottles and put the baby to sleep. So in my mentality, I think I've been grown since 10.
I realized I was grown when I was trying to ride the bus at 19 with a youth bus pass, which is 17 and under, and the bus driver knew I wasn't 17, and he kept grilling me, and I kept telling him I didn't have no ID, and he made me get off the bus because I didn't have no money to pay. That's when I realized I was grown. It's like, damn, I'm older now. It's time for me to start wising up.
That was, in order, Joshua Rafeman, Venus Morris, Brandon McFarlane, Aisha Walker, Orlando Campbell, Amina James, Shaquilla Williams, and Leon Sykes. They're all between the ages of 16 and 23, and they live in the Bay Area. Young People, Bidding Farewell to Youth, that was produced by who else? Youth Radio's Orlando Campbell with Brett Myers.
And now a story about one of my favorite endings ever. It's from the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Like the Roald Dahl book it was based on, the movie tells the story of 5 kids who win a chance to tour Willy Wonka's amazing chocolate factory. At the very end, just one child, Charlie, is left on the tour.
How did you like the chocolate factory, Charlie?
I think it's the most wonderful place in the whole world.
I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because I'm giving it to you.
Mel Stewart directed the film. He hired a young documentary maker named David Seltzer to write the screenplay. Seltzer had never written a script before. So he flew to Munich, where they were filming, and over the course of a few sleepless weeks, he furiously cranked out a screenplay. In its first draft, David Seltzer kept the ending just as it was in the book. And then, utterly exhausted, Seltzer left Germany and went to relax for a while in a tiny cabin tucked away in the woods of Maine.
There were no phones up there except for one payphone that was literally tacked to a tree. And when somebody needed somebody in the area, chances are no one would be around to hear it. Early one morning, I was going out fishing and I happened to be walking by that spot. The phone is ringing. And I picked it up, and it's Mel Stewart in Munich. He said, "What? Where the hell are you? We need you. We need to talk to you." I said, "Well, you can talk to me, but I'm kind of way far away, Mel." And he said, "We don't have an ending to the movie."
Because at that point, the ending was what was in the book, which is where Willy Wonka and Charlie's grandpa are in this glass elevator shooting up. And I think the last word was like, yippee.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly how the book ended. And Mel said, are you kidding me? All this trouble we've gone to make this movie, all the money that's gone into it, all the talent, the musical numbers, the choreography, the Oompa Loompas, it ends with the word yippee. He said, that's not a screenplay. That's not a movie. You can't do that.
So what did you do?
I said, well, let me think about it. You know, how long do I have? He said, how long? We're standing here. It's $30,000 an hour. You tell me. And I said, well, give me a second. And I think it was about 6 in the morning. And I walked out and literally looked over the lake in Maine. I thought, what the hell am I going to do? My headspace was totally out of this movie. I could barely remember what had led up to this. But I thought, okay, it's a fairy tale. It's a children's story. And how do children's stories end? I don't know. How do they end? They end with they all lived happily ever after. But that's not good. That's not what a screenwriter writes. So I took a deep swallow and I went to the phone. I said, Mel, okay, listen carefully. They're going up in the spaceship and looking at the ground disappear. And Willy Wonka announces to Charlie that the chocolate factory is his. Then Willy Wonka looks at him and he says, but Charlie, in a very cautious voice, you do know what happened to the little boy who suddenly got everything he ever wanted, don't you? And fear comes across Charlie's face, and he says, no, what? And Willie says, he lived happily ever after. And there was a long pause, and I thought, my career as a screenwriter is over. I said, Mel, are you there? And he said, fantastic. And that was it.
And that's it. That's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie.
David Seltzer, since then, you have written plenty of other films and TV shows. I'm curious, you know, when you go about writing an ending now, is there anything that you take from that experience into your writing now?
Well, I do. Number one, an ending is possibly the most important thing because the exit polls, how an audience feels leaving the movie, will either encourage or discourage more box office. I learned the hard way on a couple of movies that audiences don't want to be bummed out. Characters they have come to know and love and root for, they don't want to see them lose at the end. And so I do apply a lot of thought as to how not to totally sell out, but at the same time leave the audience with an experience that's uplifting, that's positive, that they want to go home and talk about, that they want to bond over, that they can really get to know each other better by discussing.
So with that in mind, we're not a film, we're a radio show, but we are coming to an end. But we do want to leave our listeners with a happy ending of sorts. Can you offer some advice about how to write an ending here?
Obviously, that's why you brought me here today. But I have only the same thing to offer. They all lived happily ever after. That's you. That's your crew. That's everybody who does all this good work in spite of this particular moment in time. You shall.
David Seltzer wrote the screenplay to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Thank you.
Thank you.
But Charlie, don't forget what happened to the man who suddenly got everything he always wanted.
What happened?
He lived happily ever after.
More to come after this.
Back now with Day to Day. You know, we're winding down our show on the air, but we will live on online. You can check us out there at npr.org/daydreaming. You'll see pictures of all of us there, the on-air and off-air staff, and links to where we will be. As for me, I'll be at madelinebrand.com. I'm doing a podcast there. And Alex?
You can find me online at alexcoheninla.blogspot.com. And you can also have a chance to check me out on the big screen. I've had the amazing opportunity to play myself. Well, it's actually my alter ego, Axels of Evil, in a Drew Barrymore movie. It's coming out soon called Whip It. It's about roller derby, which is a sport that I happen to play when I'm not doing radio. And I will say, as a female athlete, one of my sports heroes is Diana Nyad.
Diana Nyad, in 1979, she swam more than 102 miles from the Bahamas to Florida, and she set a long-distance record for women and men. It stood for 20 years.
I knew that this was going to be my last swim. I was 30 years old, and I thought it's about time I grow up and join the job market. And, you know, as an athlete, it's part of the tragedy of sports is that you have to retire when you're young. Nevertheless, I was swimming 102.5 miles from the Bahamas to Florida, and it took a long time. It took many, many long hours. But in the end, when I saw the shore, of course, some of the perspective started flooding. But the way to do it is not to think of the big picture, is to think of stroke by stroke and do it as perfectly as you can.
Is that what you did? Is that what you did? You took that moment in 1979 and you applied that?
I won't say that that last mile that I swam when I really, the shore was getting closer and there were several thousand people on the beach, of course I started to be flooded with the bigger picture. But I must say that I tried to, and I tried to say, this is the way to go about your life, is moment by moment. Try to be right here, doing this interview with you. You're very intense. I can see that you're truly listening to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're facing an emotional week, I'm sure, mm-hmm. as you're ending. And you've done such a good job, and your crew has, and people have enjoyed you. But you're right here doing this interview right now the way you do it well. And that's what I was doing in that last mile.
Hmm. Well, do you think that there's something about training for sports and training for big physical endurance events that prepares your mind for that more than any other activity?
I don't think it's endurance sports. I think it's sports in general. I had Olympic dreams. If you had met me when I was 10 and 11, I would say, yeah, Madeline, I'm going to be in the Olympic Games. And I had a heart disease. I had a couple other things that happened, woulda, shoulda, coulda, you know, before I started the distance swimming. But I remember when I was coming to the end of my my career as a sprint swimmer, and it was either going to make the Olympic team or not, a 16-year-old girl grabbed my shoulders and said, you know, hey, you look like you're in a fog. You're about to swim the most important 100 meters of your life. What's going on with you? And I said, oh, I've sacrificed so much. And my coach and my family, my brother and sister gave up all their dreams in the house for me. And she said, stop it. Stop it. You have the rest of your life to think about all that stuff. Right now you have 100 meters. Why don't you get in there and look, and when you finish that race, look at the little pinky of your fingernail, that little rounded half moon, and say, did I do it that well that I didn't leave even that much behind? That I swam it, yeah, I could say I couldn't have done it a fingernail faster. And it was a metaphor for me. I did that race that way, and I didn't make the Olympic team. But she said, you won't look back if you do it all just like that.
And as you said, it's pretty brutal in terms of your career, in terms of endings, because usually there's a time limit, right? I mean,
yeah.
An age limit to
yeah.
when you're you know, able to do the things you're able to do. Your body says, no, that's it. You're
yeah.
over. That's the end.
Or sometimes
you
your body
that?
Doesn't, because, you know, you could be 35 and feel quite young. I'm 59 and I feel quite young. And now, you know, to surf or boogie board or ride my bike 100 miles or bounce down the street like I own it is plenty for me. I've lowered my standards.
Well, Diana Nyad, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, and good luck to you.
Thank you. We called up two more people to talk a little bit about endings. First, Curtis Sittenfeld. She wrote the novel American Wife. And get this, our show, Day to Day, pops up on page 490.
The reason is, actually, I've worked as a journalist, not like a hard-hitting journalist, but I have, you know, written plenty of articles, and, you know, my first job out of college was as a reporter. And so I definitely try to be factually accurate as much as possible. And at one point, the main character, Alice, is in Chicago during the afternoon, and she's riding in a limo. It's sort of a secret trip, but she hears this father of a soldier who died in Iraq being interviewed on NPR. And so I looked, I literally thought, okay, what time is it? What show would be on NPR? And it was you guys. And so I thought, okay, that's perfect. So
I hate to break it to you, but we were never on in Chicago.
You weren't?
No. The station there didn't air our show.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. And I pride myself on my totally incorrect factual accuracy. Well,
okay, so it's never too late to rewrite, I guess. Her advice to us, write your own ending, because
you have to just trust yourself and write what you think should be written, because it's your book. What choice do you have?
I love that. But as we know, often the choice to end it is someone else's. Jason Kadams is the executive producer of Friday Night Lights. For the last 3 years, that show about a high school football team in Texas has faced cancellation because although it has a rabid fan base, the ratings, they're only so-so. So how does he write an ending without knowing the show's fate?
In one way, you want to give a sense of resolution. I think, you know, we owe that to the fans of the show. We owe it to ourselves. But on the other hand, we don't want to, you know, write the show in such a way that we're finishing the show. Mm-hmm. We want there to be a sense of there's more to come.
Maybe, I don't know, what ending would you craft for us? Do you believe in Hail Marys? I mean, it is a football show.
You know, my suggestion is just show up to work next week and just keep doing it and see if anybody stops you.
I think they might because the show ends on Friday.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like, what if you just kept doing it?
Oh.
You know, to me, that is the answer is, you know, you have something great and you just try to figure out a way to keep doing it.
You ready for it one last time?
I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Cohen.
Day to Day was a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. Woo!